Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Men in Blazers ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Get in on all the sports action and your chance to win up to 100 times your cash with Prize Picks, America's number one fantasy sports app. Download the app today. Use code MIB for a first deposit match up to $100. This episode is sponsored by Audible, the home of storytelling. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalogue. Audible is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases. I'm currently listening to The Secret Hours by Mick Herron. That's the standalone prequel to the majestic Slow Horses television series. I can't stop listening. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/courage or text courage to 500 500. That's audible.com/courage or text courage to 500 500. You're listening to the Men in Blazers Media Network, suboptimal radio.
Savage has lost his head and now it is all off in the corner. This will simmer long after full time. This will go on and on.
This is Rog, and you are listening to European Nights, the podcast that even more than Diego Simeone loves to exalt the virtues of suffering through football. It's our seventh episode, and we've made it to the semi-finals, dear listeners. First, Manchester City host Real Madrid, and then Liverpool welcome Villarreal. We'll drink it all in, you, me, and of course, my always guest, Rory Smith, chief soccer correspondent for the New York Times. And Rory started off by telling me some real Rory Smith European football problems.
Yeah, there's not going to be a vast amount of sympathy for this, I don't think. But the slight problem for the romance of Villarreal making it to the semi-finals of the Champions League is that there is now a reason to get to Villarreal. And it's a town of somewhere between 30 and 50,000 people on the coast of Spain, the Mediterranean coast, near Valencia, kind of near Valencia, not that near Valencia. And it doesn't obviously have its own airport because it's a tiny, tiny place. And there are a couple of airports that are kind of nearby, but not really nearby. So I now have to work out how to get from where I live in the north of England to Alicante, which actually isn't that hard because Alicante is where lots of English people go on holiday. But then go from Alicante to Villarreal. And that should be okay. But then a friend of mine called me today and pointed out that after the game, it'll be like 1 a.m. And there's no hotels in Villarreal. And unless all 50,000 people who live there drive taxis, it's not entirely clear how we get back to Valencia or to Castellón, which is up the coast, or just wherever you might be. I'm not necessarily the best at kind of confronting my issues, Rog. So I've been putting this off for quite some time.
You're procrastinating with Expedia.
And I still haven't worked out how I'm going to do it. And at some point, I'm going to have to confront it.
For you, Rory Smith, the writing is the easy part. It's the bureaucracy, which is the heart of darkness. I do love this glimpse into your life at the New York Times. Planes, trains and automobiles, the sacrifice you're making for this reporting with you in the John Candy Del Griffith role. But last time out, we were in the quarterfinals and we were treated to an epic rumble. Commentators across the world clutching at their pearls as they apparently discovered for the very first time the pugilistic fisticuffs Diego Simeone's Atletico Madrid are capable of, as one-time Manchester City player Stefan Savic went after anything wearing blue with a haircut over $50. I mean, you can mock the Queen, you can cancel Churchill, but you touch Jack Grealish's fringe and Britain must declare war. It's all we got left, I tell you. Rory, you were there in person, in Fistiana, to witness every eye gouge and kidney punch, and the wonder looked like it was rocking on TV, even long after the final whistle. Surely it was even better in real life. What was it like witnessing that argy-bargy in the flesh?
Deafening. Absolutely deafening. It was as though all 60,000 people in the Wanda were pulling Jack Grealish's hair. It was sort of this slightly visceral roar of outrage and anger from the fans. And you had Simeone orchestrating it on the touchline. He was delighted by how it had descended into somewhere between violence and farce. And then at the end, obviously, the game actually petered out a little bit after that because the momentum had got away from Atletico. But at the end, the noise went up again, even though Atleti had been eliminated. And you had pretty much everybody in the stadium stay behind to sing and to applaud and to cheer and just to howl at the moon. And it was even in defeat, a really quite inspiring sight, that bond between a team and its place, that a team and its people. And it was hard not to think quite fondly of Atletico after that, which is strange given all the criticism they got in the first leg, given the fact that as an Englishman, obviously my sense of Victorian morals was deeply offended by the idea of young men scrapping. But you kind of think, you know, they played it the way they had to play it. They did what they had to do to an extent, and they ran City really close. They tried every trick in the book, and what got City through was that they matched Atletico for the dark arts.
Yes, suddenly gritty City did tough out the second leg. They survived the Battle of the Wonder, but it remains to be seen whether the wounds they received in doing so will later prove to be mortal, because for City, it's back to Madrid in the semi-final. They will face more opposition from El Ciudad Capital for the next round. Real Madrid, who Benzema, then Modric, their way through a truly incredible, breathless second leg against Chelsea to make it here. And we're going to look at the epic prospect of their clash in a mo. But first, a reminder, catch every single match live and on demand exclusively on Paramount Plus. New subscribers can get a 7-day free trial now by going to paramountplus.com/MIB. Now to the football. Hala Madrid y nada más. Real Madrid's 21st century anthem, written by Red One and Manuel Haboy, to celebrate the club's historic 10th Champions League trophy in 2014. Zero Florida Cups, I need to add here. When you watch this video, and I do encourage you to, they try to pass off this song as actually being performed by the first team themselves, Ronaldo, Ramos, Gareth Bale and company, and once and future manager Carlo Ancelotti. But no one's buying that they have such beautiful tenors in their midst. Methinks they Milli Vanillied it. The opening lines, history that you made, history to be made, because no one can resist your desire to win. Lines that are cheesy as hell, but they perfectly capture the self-mythologizing that goes on around Real Madrid when it comes to the Champions League, as we will see as they rumble into the Etihad Stadium, Manchester, 3 p.m. Eastern on Tuesday to face Manchester City, the Arrivists, aching to win their first ever Champions League title and really validate Pep Guardiola's search for beautiful perfection. No more waffling. Let's start there with the Manchester boys in blue, appearing in their third Champions League semi-final since the Abu Dhabi group took over. And last week, Rory, you hinted at something when you said that the club and fans alike have a, quote, strange relationship with the Champions League. They don't like it because it's of UEFA. And when you said that, you didn't just mean the semi-final defeats. The whole relationship between Manchester City and UEFA really been a tug of war for leverage ever since they first qualified for the competition back in 2011. In that season's knockout tie, Porto fans were fined, and this is awful, just €20,000 for racially abusing City striker Mario Balotelli, an act which was then undermined instantly in the next round when City were fined €30,000 for being 30 seconds late onto the field for second half kickoff. This was just an early exchange in this fractious relationship. City, they've often felt that they've been made unfair targets and examples by UEFA. Rory, unpack this. Explain the fragile detente that's developed between Manchester City and UEFA year on year.
Yeah, so there are kind of two versions to it, really. One is the one that City fans, I think, tend to stick by. And that is that it started with the Porto incident and the contrast between the paltry fine that that Porto received for racially abusing Mario Balotelli. And if we're all completely honest, that they're not the only club that's received a paltry fine for their fans racially abusing somebody. That is something that UEFA have always done abysmally. And that was compounded a couple of years later when City was supposed to be playing a game behind closed doors against CSKA Moscow, who had, again, been found to have racially abused people. And as punishment, UEFA shut the stadium, which meant that no City fans could go. But somehow some CSKA Moscow fans found their way in. And City fans, I think, felt that it was almost as though UEFA were using, had kind of allowed some fans to go in because it might tip the balance in the game against City. Now, I'm sure that those incidents were deeply annoying, and I think that the frustration at them is sincerely felt among City fans. But I would be inclined to say that the actual reason for the fractious relationship with UEFA, the one that's best and most frequently sort of expressed through the booing of the UEFA anthem, which in itself is a ridiculous song, but most places don't boo it. Although, funnily enough, they did boo it heartily at Atletico Madrid. City see UEFA basically as being their principal opponents in global football. They believe that there is a cartel at UEFA that is operating specifically to keep City down. They believe that UEFA designed financial fair play with City in mind, which is, I mean, demonstrably untrue. Financial fair play predates the Abu Dhabi investment in Manchester City, at least as a concept. It was introduced after they'd come in, but it had been under discussion since Chelsea. And they believe that UEFA have done all they can at every turn to try to keep Man City out of the Champions League or out of being fulfilling their potential to be the best team in the world. Because in the eyes of City fans, UEFA are enthralled to the cabal of clubs that runs from Man United to Liverpool to Barcelona to Juventus to Bayern Munich and to Real Madrid, that actively wants Manchester City to either disappear completely or fail horribly because they see them as a threat.
It is such a select crew of clubs who have become Champions League winners, and there is such a desperation for City to etch their name into that group. And part of that resentment comes because of the struggle their team have experienced in pursuing that quest. We talked last week about what it means personally to Pep Guardiola to win this competition again, because dude really is Catalan Captain Ahab. The urge to dispel and knock on him that he can only win it with Lionel Messi powered Barcelona. Rory, what would it mean precisely for City to finally win this tournament?
This is the other interesting thing about City and the Champions League, in that I think you have to separate what it means to the club as an institution, what it means to Guardiola, and what it means to the fans. So Guardiola's really obvious because he's only been to one final since winning it with Barcelona in 2011. That was obviously with City last year. I think for him, the Champions League has a special resonance because he is so obviously a product of Barcelona, and the Champions League meant so much to Barcelona for so long because it was seen as Real Madrid's competition. He grew up in an era when Barcelona hadn't won the Champions League, and he was part of the team in 1992 that ended that wait. So I think he has a special affection for the competition. For the club, it's relatively straightforward because to Abu Dhabi, the hierarchy in power at Manchester City, I think they see the Champions League as the ultimate validation of success. It is the proof that they have arrived, that they are a genuine power, that they can stand toe-to-toe with Real Madrid and Bayern Munich and Manchester United and Liverpool. And they're going to be very disappointed when they do eventually win a Champions League, as they will, and they find out that all that happens at that point is people start saying how they've only got one. But I think for them, as it is for PSG, the Champions League is the ultimate trophy. It's the one that carries the most global weight. But I'm still not convinced the fans see it the same way. So I remember in the early years of City, what really meant something to the fans was the Premier League. They wanted to end that 44-year wait for a Premier League title. They wanted to be champions of England. To be honest, for a long time, what they really wanted was to be the best team in Manchester. That was their main objective. Do you remember the flag at Old Trafford?
Of course. How long City had not won to be candid, I'm still reeling after the Liverpool fans held up the 1995 banner, the derby at the weekend, which again, second mention is Florida Cup erasure, but continue.
I think in a week like this, Rod, you've got to cling on to what you whatever you can. The you find your life raft and you just grab hold of it. But yeah, so I think for City fans, the primary objective when Abu Dhabi arrived was to bring that flag down, basically, was to end United's hegemony in Manchester and in England. I can't speak for Man City fans, and I wouldn't presume to know their minds, but the impression I've always got is that being eliminated from the Champions League, certainly until the last couple of years, has been greeted more or less with a shrug. And partly that's because there's this conviction that UEFA are kind of arrayed against them, and there have been incidents where they have every right to feel hard done by, none more so than in the eliminations to Liverpool and Spurs, which were both mildly controversial. But partly because I don't think that the fans feel a particular kinship with the tournament, because being champions of Europe isn't something that successive generations of Manchester City fans have been brought up to think about. The prospect of being champions of England, the prospect of being better than United, now that matters in a really kind of deep-seated way. But I think it's in the Champions League that maybe, I don't know, they see a little bit of the unreality of their situation, that this essentially, you know, reasonably successful but basically quite mediocre club has suddenly been transformed into one of the great powers of European football. That must on some level feel unreal to the fan.
You know, at the end of the day, I'm kind of surprised in all of this that City Group aren't just satiated by hanging the world's tiniest banner proclaiming MLS Cup victory up in the rafters of Yankee Stadium. Some people, enough is never enough. But from the club that have said they suffer prejudicial treatment from UEFA, to the club that's really like a walking billboard for their competitions, Real Madrid, the most winningest team in Champions League history, whose white shirts shine like none other under the evening floodlights. For proof, just watch again the key moments of that exhausting, poetic, two-legged quarter-final affair in which they outwitted, well, really more outlasted, defended champions Chelsea. One of those incredible, enrapturing ties in which the stadium, the fans and the players seem to be in perfect concert, the twists and turns of which only the emotions of the stoic Carlo Ancelotti seemed immune to. And at the final whistle, all 22 players on the field collapse to the ground, having reinforced the life truth that playing football with Real Madrid is a simple game. You chase a ball for 90 to 120 minutes, and at the end, Karim Benzema will score the decisive goal and break your heart. Real Madrid, in their 120-year history, have won that trophy, as I said, 13 bloody times since first beating Stade de Reims in the Parc des Princes in Paris way back in 1956. This club, this fan base and their opponents are very used to watching Los Blancos win games when that final whistle blows. But as you wrote in the New York Times last week, it seemed especially dramatic this year. In your mind, is it their pedigree that automatically lifts a certain panache to their game in key moments? Or are their tactics, their footballing reasons, why the games have been so gripping in the final act this year?
Well, the first thing I should say is that song, Hala Madrid y Nada Más, may be my favourite piece of music.
Why?
I have no idea. Is it objectively awful? But the Ya Corre La Saeta. I apologise for my tunelessness. I can't do anything about it.
You don't have the voice of Gareth Bale, let me be clear.
Let's be fair. There is a reason I was not invited to pretend to sing on that particular track. But there's just something about the... Do you know what? It's the ridiculous pomposity of it all just fits Real Madrid perfectly. No club wears its self-importance so well as Real Madrid. That can manifest in sort of negative ways, such as when they try to launch breakaway Super Leagues. But generally, on a Champions League night at the Bernabeu, there is a feeling of occasion and grandeur and importance that you don't really get anywhere else, even at Camp Nou, even at Old Trafford, even at the Allianz. The Bernabeu is the quintessential Champions League stadium. This incredibly imposing building, just kind of plonked in the middle of Madrid on a very, very busy 8 or 10 lane road, I guess, that seems to take about half an hour to cross. And it rises sheer from the ground, these huge kind of swirling turrets. And then you go inside, and normally this is the real privilege of my job. The media, the foreign media particularly, tend to sit on the top tier of the Bernabeu. So you looked down to the pitch, which is about a mile away, and all you see are these really steep stands full of people in white shirts, and this noise that rises up from beneath you and hits you in the face. There is nothing quite like it. And I'm sure there are tactical reasons behind Real Madrid's unerring ability to not lose games in the Champions League. And obviously part of it's to do with the quality of their players. But I do think on nights like that, it's much more to do with where you are and who they are and what they're wearing and what the fans feel. And that sense of event, of this is Real Madrid in the Champions League and the usual rules do not apply. In the PSG game a few weeks ago is the best example. That PSG had that game sewn up. They were far better than Real Madrid. And then Gigi Donnarumma forgets to control the football and everything. And in that instant, you just feel all of Real Madrid's history kind of rush to the surface. And people can't resist it. And I think that applies to Real's players who are lifted by it. But I also think that the opposition players wouldn't be human if they weren't affected by it. They will all have grown up not only watching Real Madrid win Champions League games, but knowing that Real Madrid win Champions League games, seeing the Bernabeu on FIFA, which I think is crucially important. You are in a place that you have played on a video game and has become incredibly familiar to you through that kind of digital interface. That there is something that happens and I'm certain it affects the opposition.
It's how I feel when I'm confronted by a four-lane highway and I have to cross it. Just years of playing Frogger, just history seeps through and acts as the ultimate intangible. But the other line that runs through this tie, Rory, and one that's been on my mind of late as we crossed its one-year anniversary 2 weeks ago. My God, this year has gone so fast. The European Super League, may it rest, but not in peace. These two clubs, of course, were part of the guilty founding 12. This year's competition has already witnessed a number of clashes between erstwhile Super League club plotters, Atletico Madrid and Manchester United, Liverpool and Inter. But this match really is a unique pairing. Real Madrid, whose president, Florentino Perez, was the sole chairman of the Super League, facing Manchester City, who were the first club to jump ship. Pep Guardiola himself said, it's not really sport if success is guaranteed. The clubs all got a fine, but no one really went down with the ship, despite their best efforts. And here we are, with three out of four of the teams left in the semi-finals, Super League founding members, both semi-finals, both Spanish versus English teams too. Rory, in the context of what we're about to watch this week, is it fair to say that while we avoided the Super League, the hegemony it sought to enforce, the cabal that sought to enforce it, are very much same as it ever was?
Well, that's the irony of the Super League, that they gave it a name and made it a thing, and that gave people something to shoot at, effectively. Because the Super League exists. We should all morally be supporting Villarreal this week because they were the one team that weren't involved. But there will be a sense if Villarreal make the final, though lots of people will say, well, it's only Villarreal, it doesn't matter. And that's kind of indicative of the attitude that you get. Even before UEFA announced the changes to the Champions League that will kick in 2024, which basically expands it so it's much harder for the big teams to get knocked out. They get more chances to stay in. And potentially has legacy places for teams who don't qualify, but if they've done well enough in previous years in the Champions League, they will get a place. Even before all of that, the Champions League is already effectively a Super League. There is a two-tier system in operation in Europe. The teams that regularly have Champions League income are now probably better thought of not as Premier League teams or Bundesliga teams or La Liga teams, but Champions League teams. And there are, ironically, probably about 12 of them, maybe a little bit more once you throw in PSG, Bayern Munich and Borussia Dortmund. They are the teams that are always there, that always have access to that money. That money distorts their domestic competition. So the Super League exists in a form. It just doesn't have the name that they wanted to give it. And I think you can make the case that Guardiola is absolutely right, that it's not sport if success is guaranteed, which makes you wonder quite what he makes of the reality of football at this point.
Oh, God, the ability to see inside Pep's mind. Oh, but for only a day. This is what we are left with. The team with the greatest disdain for the Champions League against the team of greatest desire. One who will play breathtaking football versus the other who has the ability to conjure gasps like no other. City host Real Madrid, 3 p.m. Eastern, Tuesday on Paramount Plus. I can't bloody wait for that. We will be back to discuss the other semi-final after this.
Paramount Plus is your choice for championship soccer.
Oh, magnificent!
Streaming the best teams and biggest stars from around the world.
Giant stars, huge action.
From UEFA Champions League.
And Messi, tour de force!
Serie A, NWSL, and the CONCACAF World Cup qualifiers.
For the save!
Plus the best action from South America and Asia.
Oh my word, what a goal!
So how do you choose from so many champions? You don't have to. This is the best of CBS Sports. Streaming on Paramount Plus.
Onward to triumph, to victory. Villarreal, that is the sound of Villarreal fans singing their club hymn, packing the streets of their little city with no airport that really pisses off Rory Smith. Well, their heroes were off in Germany. Oh, just recording a truly historic result. Rory, we should have known Villarreal would top Bayern Munich. Retrospectively, you can make the case it was actually the most predictable result of the round. Up the tile makers, underrated by a massive opponent yet again. It means they travel to take on Liverpool at Anfield Wednesday, 3 p.m. Eastern on Paramount Plus. Oh, to watch that, the yellow submarine travelling to the home of the Beatles is going to be some bloody spectacle. Mighty Liverpool, another team whose stadium could comfortably seat the population of Villarreal about twice over. And no disrespect to Unai Emery's two previous opponents, but Jurgen Klopp surely will not be the third to make the mistake of underestimating the little Valencian side. More on that a little later, but first Liverpool, who will take this match with utmost seriousness, as they will with every single game they take the field for from here on out. They are legit chasing a quadruple, something that, you know, we kind of all joked about to begin with. We all mentioned it because it was a thing, but no one really expected it, I don't think, to get to this stage. I mentioned it mostly in a half jinxy way for a couple of months, but it's no longer an intriguing possibility, a pot of gold at the end of some faint rainbow. Obviously, a quadruple, footballingly, is a truly astounding achievement. Just how hard is it to do this on a practical level, Rory?
It's completing a season, isn't it? That's basically completing football. If you win every trophy in one season, you've completed it. That's it. There's an argument that if you do it, you should be forced to disband as a club and just accept that, right, that's as good as you're going to get.
You've got me interested, Rory.
There you go. I thought that'd perk you up. There's a reason that Klopp has downplayed it, and that is that obviously it's never been done before. And I'm a little bit pedantic on this. So I would say that they are still theoretically capable of a quadruple. I would not say they're on course for a quadruple because Man City have got more points than them in the league. So the lead is not in their hands. So I don't think it's quite right to say they're on course for a quadruple, but it is, as you say, a possibility. It's an incredibly rare achievement to win every trophy if you're engaged in a three-front battle. If you throw in the League Cup, which let's not forget is a little bit arbitrary. You know, teams don't always take the early rounds desperately seriously. You tend to get a lot of youth team players playing. That, in a way, kind of makes it, sounds a bit counterintuitive, but kind of harder to win because you're not necessarily, you're not sending out your best team every single time. So I think to do it, you need not only to be a little bit lucky, but you also need to have a certain depth of squad. You need to have an ability to rotate players and keep them happy, to keep them fresh enough to play, but not tire them out. And you also need, obviously, to be extraordinarily good. And so the fact that this isn't a very footballing argument, but the fact that Liverpool have got this close, that in itself is an extraordinary achievement. What happens after this, to an extent, is a bonus.
The idea of a quadruple, it's amazing. I mean, I am in awe of it, awe of the human achievement, the leadership achievement of Jurgen Klopp, the consistency and focus of that football team. But it's also a little bit sobering when you dig into it. You've described the footballing world we live in as having an obsession with the multiplicative, teams obsessed with winning doubles, triples, and yes, quadruples. You know, we are essentially cheering Excel spreadsheets because the richest teams can and will and do win everything in many of the quote top five leagues. That concept of success has been broken and redefined to the outside world. Bayern have just locked up their truly silly 10th straight Bundesliga, PSG or Juventus before they cocked up the code, winning the leagues almost passe, winning a double, forgettable, winning a treble. That'll make the history books. And you know, the treble was heralded as the sign of generational achievement when Manchester United did it in 1999. But since 2010, it's happened five times across these leagues. Rory, give us some clarity how we became so obsessed with this multi-quadruply world of football and what it really says about what we're watching.
Well, I think that's a really good point, and it's something that probably shouldn't be forgotten as Liverpool go for it, and as, you know, City potentially close in on a Champions League and Premier League double as well. I'm old enough to remember, as you will be, when the double in England was incredibly rare.
Incredible.
When only the greatest teams had done the double. Spurs in 61, Arsenal in 71, I think, Liverpool in 86. There were at most, I think, three or four teams that had done the double in history. And then in the 1990s, Manchester United basically did it every year. And then Arsenal did it twice. And it kind of lost its allure. It wasn't special doing the double anymore.
Just a double.
And I think to an extent, it's a reaction to the fact that the same teams now win all the same trophies. I think in that sort of environment, winning a league title is no longer that impressive. So you need to find a way to gauge them, gauge how good they truly are. And the way to do that is to look for the multiplicative. Is, have you done a double or a treble, or in England's case, a quadruple? That becomes the gauge of true kind of historical greatness. And I think that is worrying for two reasons. One is for the teams themselves, because there is a world in which, and it's not that unlikely, Liverpool end this season, say, with the Carabao Cup and the FA Cup, and they are dressed up as failures. That's something that I think American sport has a much healthier relationship with. The ability to recognise achievement that doesn't end in a medal, I think, is something that comes more naturally in American sport because of the way that the season is divided up. And the other is that it is a really damning indictment of the competitive level of leagues and teams across Europe. This is something I think regularly about the FA Cup, that what these tournaments actually need is to be won by teams for whom they really mean something in and of themselves.
To the team that Liverpool will be more than a little wary of, that little yellow submarine that could, Villarreal, who defied those treble-winning sides, Juventus and Bayern Munich, to grab a spot in this semi-final like no other left in the tournament. I do wonder if manager Unai Emery ever suspected that he would get closer to a Champions League title with Villarreal than he did with Paris Saint-Germain. But for those who missed the second leg against Bayern, to be clear, Villarreal did not lock up and hold firm like some coastal Spanish Burnley. Their game plan was really one of composure, playing intricate triangles to emerge out the Bayern press and prevent their opponents from dictating play. It's magical. It seemed to shock Bayern. Really, there was an amazing moment on a set piece in the first half when the Villarreal backline sprung an offside trap which caught seven Bayern Munich players offside. It bore out one of the quotes of the tournament from midfielder Dani Parejo, who said, when the draw was made and they got Villarreal, their coach, whom I don't know, disrespected not only Villarreal, but also football by saying he wanted to settle a tie by the end of the first leg. It was disrespectful. Sometimes when you spit up, it falls on your face. And he's referring to Bayern's sporting director, Hasan Salihamidzic, who went on Bayern TV after the draw and laughed out loud, saying, let's put it this way, it's a very feasible draw. Rory, what do you see happening between these two?
Yeah, I think you've actually got a really interesting tactical encounter, which sounds like I think it's going to be a really boring game, but it doesn't. Because Liverpool are a system team. They have one idea and they do it really well. That's kind of what Klopp's built his success on. And there are little intricate changes within that. But basically, you know what you're getting with Liverpool. Emery's got a different kind of approach. His team are much more reactive. They wait to see how the opposition want to play. They bend and shape themselves around that. I wouldn't say they have a defining kind of philosophical vision of how football should be played. They just think that you should win the matches. And we saw them do that brilliantly against Juventus. We saw them do it twice against Bayern, as they outplayed Bayern in the first leg in Spain and then outsmarted them in the second. They've got some really good footballers. They're not a pushover. And I think that there will be a temptation to present them as an easy draw. That disrespects a team that has beaten Bayern Munich. I think once you beat Bayern Munich, you should be taken seriously. That wasn't a fluke. They will be able to shut Liverpool down probably more effectively than anyone else, and without resorting to some of the tricks that may or may not have appeared in the Merseyside derby on Sunday. I can't see Chukwueze pretending to be injured twice in 5 minutes.
I mean, Richarlison's not that kind of player.
No, I mean, Richarlison is perhaps more that kind of player than any player who's ever existed. But the Villarreal won't be favourites. Liverpool should be favourites to make it through. But they've got 180 minutes of torture ahead of them against a team that will shut them down at any given opportunity.
You sold me on torture. That match kicks off at 3 p.m. Eastern on Wednesday via Paramount Plus. And watch keenly, listeners. Warning, we will be covering this game live on Twitch with guests, including two remarkable US men's stars, Walker Zimmerman and one of my favourites, Matt Turner, as well as Sarah Gordon. And there will be more. Join us Wednesday, 2:45 p.m. Eastern Time at twitch.tv/meninblazers. Genuinely cannot wait to be with you on that platform. We'll be back to get into the Europa League after a quick word from our loved ones at Paramount Plus.
Paramount Plus is your choice for championship soccer.
Oh, magnificent!
Streaming the best teams and biggest stars from around the world.
Giant stars, huge action.
From UEFA Champions League.
A Messi tour de force!
Serie A, NWSL, and the CONCACAF World Cup qualifiers.
For the save! There is it!
Plus the best action from South America and Asia.
Oh my word, what a goal!
So how do you choose from so many champions? You don't have to. This is the best of CBS Sports. Streaming on Paramount Plus.
Frankfurt fans, oh God, did they have a party in Barcelona? What you just heard was the estimated 30,000 travelling Frankfurt supporters rocking up to the away end of Barcelona's Camp Nou to see their team rip more holes in Barca's net than even Xavi has in his jeans. An incredible 3-2 win 30 minutes after the final whistle. When the Camp Nou PA announcer tried to get them to leave the stadium, they responded by singing their club song, Im Herzen von Europa, in the heart of Europe. And after splashing around on the Barcelona beaches, Frankfurt will hit London to face up to the war bubbles of West Ham Thursday, 3 p.m. Eastern, for their Europa League semi-final. West Ham also had a night of nights on the road in the last round in Lyon, 3-0 win for the Hammers on tour. This matchup, they are not too dissimilar in ethos. Frankfurt, a founding member of the Bundesliga, been around since the turn of the 20th century. Bit of an up and down club between the first and second division, and their fans savour every single step of the European journey, European night after European night that they can get.
Frankfurt do have this remarkable relationship with European football, and I guess it must be, this is a bit kind of basic, but it must be partly just because they're not there every year. They don't take it for granted. They are a team that realises that it's special to have these adventures. And so they tend to travel in numbers whenever they are in the Europa League. And Frankfurt, I actually did a story on the Bundesliga last week, and I was expecting, you know, the small talk at the start of the call to be about, you know, their memories of their night in Barcelona. I didn't realise that so many of them would still be travelling back. They seem to really kind of make the journey, to drag the journey out. So I spoke to a couple of them spoke to one guy who just got home. That was about 10 days after. And another one who was still on a train somewhere in Europe. because he'd obviously decided, well, I'm in Barcelona and get back overland. I'll take my time about it. And that, as we've said before, that's what these trips are all about.
It's like how I like to imagine you on the way back from Villarreal, Rory. But win or lose in both of these legs, one thing's certain, a massive night for pubs around the stadiums in both London and Frankfurt. The other Europa League semi-final, Rangers versus Leipzig, Tyler Adams, God bless, facing the Scottish team his dad, Daryl, grew up dreaming of playing for. Both games kick off 3 p.m. Eastern Thursday on Paramount Plus. And in the Conference League, the best conference since the one that broke Tom Cruise at the beginning of Jerry Maguire, there's yet another English team in a European semi-final, Leicester City. They host Roma on Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern time as well. Those bullies, Roma, who just had to go and ruin Bodo's dream sausage water-filled run. It does grant us, though, the Brendan Rodgers versus Jose Mourinho clash that the European Conference League has long cried out for since it began. Feyenoord and Marseille duke it out in the other semi-final again, 3 p.m. Eastern time on Thursday. All the Europa League and Conference League matches available on Paramount+. Rory, what are your keen eyes drawn to most in the mix of those games?
Well, I think the Conference League semi-finals are a great lineup, not just as a Rodgers and Mourinho, but Feyenoord Marseille. They're two properly sort of heavyweight European teams. You get this intriguing possibility that if Marseille make it through, and obviously I don't want them to, just my affections now that Bodo are out have switched to Feyenoord because of my friend who travelled all over Europe watching them. If Marseille make it through and win it, they should finish second in Ligue 1. That would be probably the best season of any team in France, even though PSG have won the title. They claimed it last weekend with a victory over Lens in Paris, with a wonderful Lionel Messi goal. But the fans are so sort of unhappy and discontented with the Qatari project in Paris that there were barely any celebrations in the stands. The players are all delighted to be champions of France again, or certainly they wanted it to be seen that they were delighted. But there is something really unhappy at PSG at the moment. And I do think it would be kind of ironic if Marseille were to finish second, which for Marseille is as high as they can realistically finish, and win a European title, because that would almost put PSG's season in the shade. And in a way, this is what we've talked about a lot in lots of different contexts today, but in a way, that's what clubs like Marseille, that's all they can do. Try and find ways to make the super clubs maybe feel a bit less than they do.
The antics of Jorge Sampaoli on the touchline for Marseille, often worth the price of admission alone. And if you needed another reason to tune in and are prone to a bit of mid-2010s nostalgia, there is, of course, that magician, Dimitri Payet, who does things with a football typically only seen in Roadrunner cartoons. That match kicks off on Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern time on Paramount+. Rory, before we go, let's imagine that I was one of the thousands of Frankfurt fans, no doubt even now descending upon the London Stadium. You were my local guide. Lucky me, Rory Smith. Where are you taking me to eat in London? That's big smoke!
London obviously is home to more than seven restaurants, and so it's actually quite difficult to choose. And strictly speaking, I should go for like Dishoom or, you know, one of the other places in Soho. But I'm actually going to go for an Egyptian food stall in Borough Market.
Oh!
So I left London about 8 years ago. Is that right? No, 6 years ago. And I only used to go into my office at the Times of London once a week to record a podcast with Gab Marcotti.
I love that podcast.
It was an intellectually draining experience.
You always pissed him off. I loved it.
He really hated me. It was a really unlikely success story.
I loved it. It was like watching a great episode of Scooby-Doo and Scrappy-Doo.
But anyway, afterwards, I would always treat myself as a reward for annoying Marcotti sufficiently to some kashari, which is an Egyptian street food, which is basically a little bowl of vermicelli with tomatoes and spices and onion and then kind of crunchy stuff on top. And I'm a great believer in the food group known as crunchy stuff. And it's healthy. It's a healthy snack. It was obviously it's London, so it was inordinately expensive for something that came in a pot. But I looked forward to it every week. It made annoying Gab all the sweeter just to know that at the end of it, there would be some Egyptian street food for me. So I would take you to the kashari stall at Borough Market. And because it's you, Roger, I'd even pay for you, even though it costs £4.95.
God bless you. I'd love that in your mind, Gab Marcotti is inextricably word associated with kashari. That is a wonderful mind trick. But I've got to say, if you did ever take me to Borough Market, which is one of the most joyous culinary spots on earth. I will be leaving with at least a dozen more things. There'll be specialist beers, gelatos, wine-soaked cheeses, and most certainly some of Barney's famous jellied eels stuck right down my pants. Best way to smuggle them into the London Stadium right after our visit, Rory Smith. That is all for this week, you beautiful man. Thank you, as ever, for your wisdom on global geopolitics and local gastronomy alike. We'll be back this time next week to chat about the second leg of these semi-finals. Please make them finally poised still. Remember, everything we discussed today is available live and on demand exclusively on Paramount Plus. Until next week, courage, and to our listeners in Frankfurt, Mut! Hey Prime members, you can listen to Men in Blazers ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know, after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used, because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.